the new theater of the mind. The Bruce Collins Show.
Welcome back to the Bruce Collins Show. We're very glad to have you join us. Tonight we talk to Jeffrey D. Johnson about his new book, The Absurdity of Unbelief. The Bruce Collins Show airs every Thursday night at 10 p.m. on WWPR, 1490 a.m. You can also catch the show on Fridays at 10 p.m. Eastern Time online at ipbn-fm.com. That's ipbn-fm.com. Please tell your friends about The Bruce Collins Show, and you can join us on Facebook at The Bruce Collins Show page. If you'd like to contact us, you can email us at bruce_collins_show@aol.com. We also have a new website, thebrucecollinsshow.com. Again, that's thebrucecollinsshow.com. The Bruce Collins Show also has a YouTube channel. Visit YouTube, search for The Bruce Collins Show channel, subscribe, and catch all the latest shows on YouTube. And by the way, we also have a program on IPBN on Monday nights at 10 p.m. Eastern Time called The Big Finale, and you can get both The Big Finale and The Bruce Collins Show on The Bruce Collins Show channel on YouTube. So if you subscribe there, you get both programs in one channel right there on YouTube. And did I mention it's on YouTube? And now let me introduce my co-host, Chad Miles. Chad is a former congressional candidate in Michigan and a military veteran, and is the founder and webmaster at Conspiria.net and also ZippyCheese.com. You can also find out more information on Chad at ChadMiles.com. He's radio's lethal weapon, Chad Miles. Welcome back to the program, Chad.
Hello.
Hey, Chad. It's another great week, Chad.
Hey, I noticed you're in a better mood this week. Did the doctor increase your dosage?
Excuse me?
Never mind. Hey, why are you so happy, Bruce?
Well, I heard that Jekyll Barry DuPont Sr. has finally had some success getting Junior to check into a loony bin.
I'm pretty sure that loony bin is not a medical term.
Yeah, I think loony bin is where people store their Bugs Bunny cartoons. What I meant to say is rubber room.
That's not politically correct.
I'm not running for office, Chad.
Okay. So you're saying that Colin is going to a mental health facility?
His name is not Colin, Chad. How many times do I have to say that?
Well, he's not Colin.
That's right.
And he is.
Stop it! I won't have propaganda on my show. I'm a broadcast journalist.
Oh, like associating yourself with the media elevates your credibility?
Thank you.
I still don't think that Jekyll Berry Jr. needs to be locked up.
Oh, believe me, he does. I heard the other day he was all mixed up and ate pancakes for breakfast.
Well, there's nothing unusual about eating pancakes for breakfast. Senior Pickles eats them all the time.
Yeah, but when Junior eats pancakes, he scratches the top pancake and pours syrup over the itch on his head. I'm telling you, he's all mixed up.
Well, that does sound unusual.
We actually have Jekyll Barry DuPont Jr. on the line right now.
Oh, really?
Jekyll Barry Jr., are you there? Hey, he's on the line, right? Jekyll Barry?
Hey, Colin, are you there?
Hello, gentlemen. How are you? I have a poem for both of you.
Oh, awesome.
Are you ready?
Oh. Yeah.
Tell me you're ready.
Come on, Bruce. Tell him you're ready.
I'll never be ready.
Go ahead, Colin.
Oh, roses are red. Netflix has rentals. Daddy talked to me, and he says I'm mental.
Well, that was beautiful.
Okay, don't say that, Bruce. Jekyll Berry Jr., are you sure you want to go through with this? You know, there are other options.
Chad, don't give him options. This is for the best.
Daddy said I should do it, and I'm trying to look on the bright side, guys. I'll be out in a few months, and in the meantime, I can write poetry while I'm in there.
There's something criminal when Colin says daddy. Anyway, absolutely, Colin. It's like a healthy cereal vacation.
What's a healthy cereal vacation?
It's packed with fruits, nuts, and flakes.
Okay, that wasn't funny.
Hey, what's the difference between a psychiatrist and a magician?
I don't know.
A psychiatrist pulls habits out of rats.
Okay, that also wasn't funny.
Well, at least I'm consistent.
Well, guys, I just want to thank you for both helping me. And I wanted to say goodbye to all my fans from the radio show.
You have fans? Nobody likes me, and it's my show.
Yeah, I wonder why.
Chad, I also want to thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Colin.
Wait a minute. Why didn't you thank me?
Because we're family.
No, we are not. Get that through your thick head. We are not family.
Oh, I always hate to see family arguments.
Chad, this is not a family argument. Knock it off.
Okay, guys, before I go, I'd like to leave you all with a poem. There once was a man from Nantucket.
Whoa. Stop. I just don't like where this one's headed.
I agree. There's nothing that rhymes with Nantucket except maybe ruckus. And nothing ever good comes from a ruckus. Good call, Chad.
Well, gentlemen, there's nothing more to say. I guess this is goodbye for now. Perhaps we'll meet again.
Highly unlikely.
Hey, take care of yourself, Colin.
Yeah, break a leg, and I mean that from the bottom of my heart. Now let's move on. Joining us right now from our program, The Big Finale, for our news segment is Gabe Reed. Again, he's from The Big Finale. How goes it, Gabe?
Fantastic, Bruce.
Excellent. Now, Chad, do you have any news for us? We'd like Gabe to sit in with us on this news segment here.
Well, that's a good idea, Bruce, and as a matter of fact, I do.
Great.
Shannon Eglund, 41, already convicted in 2014 of running a mortgage fraud operation during the 2004-2008 real estate boom, pleaded guilty in May 2016 to the subsequent crime of deliberately having himself shot to gain his judge's sympathy and to collect on disability insurance that he had purchased the week before.
Smart.
Eglund, scheduled to start a 10-year sentence for the 2014 conviction, told the judge he had been assaulted by gunfire when he stopped in traffic to help a pregnant woman. But in reality, he had ordered his teenage son to shoot him in the legs with a 20-gauge shotgun.
Wow.
That's a real story from the Associated Press.
That's desperate.
Yeah, that's
very... A 20-gauge shotgun. That's kind of serious.
Yeah.
Not as serious as a 12-gauge, but it's more serious than a 410.
And instead of getting any sympathy, he just had extra crime added to his sentence.
And he is. And he's killed. Yeah.
Hamburger meat for legs.
Really? Well, they just slid him through the bars, see?
It says in the legs, not just like one leg. Like, shoot me in the leg.
Yeah, shoot me in the other one.
Shoot the other one.
Aim for the middle. Get them both at the same time. Make it hurt quick.
Yeah, make it look real. Shoot me at both.
I got to get some sympathy.
Yeah. Why do one when you can do two?
Right. He's an overachiever.
I had a two-for-one deal on these shells, and I'm going to take advantage of it.
Moving on.
Now, you know what he said after he was shot in both legs? I'm proud of you, son.
Happy Father's Day. I'm gonna spoil something right off the bat. I'm gonna say this next news story is probably the best out of all of them. So I just want to say that right now. Say that up front. Maybe I should save it for last. No, I'll go ahead and read it.
Your call.
This correction appeared in the New York Times print edition of May 10th, and it begins, quote, "Because of an editing error, an article on Monday, May 9th, about a theological battle being fought by Muslim imams and scholars in the West against the Islamic State misstated the Snapchat handle used by Suhaib Webb, one of the Muslim leaders speaking out." It is in this is the actual Snapchat handle, Imam Suhaib Webb. It is not Pimpin' for Paradise 786.
Where did that come from?
This was actually in the New York Times, ladies and gentlemen. Wow. Pimpin' for Paradise, 786.
I bet that guy got a lot of followers all of a sudden.
Pimpin' for Paradise.
Suhab, you are pimping for paradise in Snapchat?
Oh, boy. Okay. Moving on. That story speaks for itself.
He's an imam, so he's like a religious leader, right?
Correct.
So pimping for paradise is way out of character, I would say.
And it's pimping for paradise 786. Like, this was already taken, so he had to put some numbers on the end of it.
But technically, I think that's exactly what he does.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
That's a good point.
I could just wonder how that mistake was made, though, by the New York Times.
Yeah, where did they get...
Okay, Bob, go out and find the information. Okay, this imam, he's on Snapchat, and his handle is Pimpin' for Paradise.
Intern.
Yeah.
Intern. All right, next story. Government agent... This is a good one, too. This might be even better than that one, actually.
This is insane.
Government agencies trying legally or not to hide details from public inquiries under freedom of information demands usually resort to indelibly blackening out what they do not want to be revealed. But the Public Health Agency of Canada recently tried a unique method, according to an Associated Press correspondent. The AP had requested files on the 2014 Ebola outbreak, and revealed reporter Raphael Satter, the documents finally arrived from the PHA with parts carefully redacted using scotch tape and paper.
So just covered up.
This is unbelievable. Satter reported that he got everything the AP had asked for by merely peeling back the tape. A Dallas Morning News reporter commenting on Satter's experience wrote, "Canadians are so nice." That was from the Toronto Star.
Hey, we're sorry we used so much tape, eh?
Yeah. So ordinarily you get these papers and they have the black marked out so you can't read it. Like you see all those UFO papers that are on TV and they show this piece of paper and it says the, and then there's a big black... They just took a piece of paper and tape and taped over the words they didn't want the guy to see. So he just peels it back so he can read it.
Well, there's two options here. I actually, when I was involved in as an intelligence analyst when I was in the Army, on my second enlistment, I actually had to go through this process of FOIA requests, and I actually had to go through some documents and redact them. And I was given a set of guidelines, and how we did it was we were given the guidelines of redaction. You go through the documents, and then you black out with a black marker things that were supposed to be redacted. You would copy the document first, do the redaction with a marker, and then you would recopy with the redaction so you couldn't read what was redacted.
On a ditto machine, right?
No, it wasn't. I'm not that old. It was a Xerox.
I mean, just make the copy as bad as possible.
Well, yeah. Well, the point is, if you were to copy the page and then redact it with a marker, you could see what it said through the marker. But if you copied it again, you can't read what was redacted.
And they also told Chad when he was making copies, don't stare at the light. So, you know, that brings up an important point. Do you suppose the bozo that sent him these copies with the paper and tape was supposed to copy it and not send it that way?
Well, that's the way it seems to me, although that seems like a lot of work when you can just go through with a marker. But that was probably the case. So did he send original documents?
Apparently.
But, I mean, here's the point I was going to make. Either this person's really not very smart, or they're a disgruntled employee,
or
and
both.
They said, fine, I'm going to redact, quote unquote, and I'm going to send it just like this. So yeah. I don't know which it is.
It would have only been worse if he would have had the paper and it showed up with the extra piece of paper and scotch tape around the parts that he wasn't supposed to see. It would have only been worse if the guy would have drawn an arrow to the pieces that he was supposed to lift up.
Or gone through and highlighted the redaction part.
Open here. It's sort of like the 25 Days of Christmas, those little windows you open up. It's like, what surprise will I find behind this one?
A FOIA advent calendar.
Yeah.
Just what I've always wanted.
Yes. Oh, my goodness. The prime minister is a reptilian, it says here.
Peel back. It's like a game. Peel back the tape and see what you find.
And see if you win a Big Mac.
Moving on. Michael Blevins, age 37, reported to Florida Hospital in Orange City. This is a good one, too. Reported to Florida Hospital in Orange City near Daytona Beach in May. After finally realizing 3 days after the fact that he had shot himself while cleaning his handgun.
Oh, man.
He said he was on pain medication and besides was wearing a black shirt.
For 3 days?
That obscured blood stains.
I didn't notice the blood stains. I got my ratty black shirt on.
He's gaping hole.
Yeah.
Right. He said that he had felt a sharp pain, but that, it had aggravated his back injury, causing him to fall and hit his head against a coffee table, and thus was not aware of the origin of the loud noise the .22 caliber handgun had made.
Wow.
That's from News 9.
Just around in there.
It's not like a 20-gauge shotgun. I mean,
exactly.
It's a .22.
But look at all the problems he had. He was on pain medication. He accidentally shot himself. He didn't know he had shot himself. He had back injury, and he hit his head on the coffee table.
And he was wearing the same shirt for 3 days.
Yeah. This guy's got problems.
A lot of problems.
Yeah.
Cuts down on laundry.
Yeah, I bet he had a big hospital bill.
When he finally made it.
I got this sharp pain in my side. Ooh, look at that. There's a bullet wound.
Well, I shot myself.
Sir, do you mind if we bathe you while you're here?
Yeah.
Wait, that shirt's not black.
Can we use the jaws of life on your T-shirt? Man.
Okay, moving on. Apparently, Japanese taste buds easily become bored. For manufacturers seem eager to create extravagant food combinations to satisfy them that might prove daunting to most Americans.
You know, it sounded like you said eager in Japanese, though. You said eager.
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 Kaiju.
The sumo wrestler. Eager.
Donald Trumparoo.
Japanese taste buds. Eager.
That's pretty good, Bruce.
Hey.
The latest exhibit, the familiar...
new flavored Fukushima.
Oh, you just crossed the line. Now we're going to get hate
Bruce.
Mail.
Too soon.
We're going to get hate mail again after that whole Atlantis thing.
I know. That's coming.
Oh,
that's coming. I re-listened to that segment, and boy, am I embarrassed. But I'm going to air it.
Well, you will be the recipient of the deluge of hate mail, I'm sure. Yeah.
You know, I put a disclaimer at the beginning, and I said I was making
fun. Did you really?
Yeah, I said I was making fun of the Cosby kids. I want to make that clear.
Will this air before that or after?
Well, you know what? We make fun of all kinds of people, and I made that clear also. So,
Will this segment air before the other one?
This should air before that, I believe.
People. Don't miss that round table.
Yeah, that's
if you listen to one big finale round table in your entire life, listen to that one.
And if Gary Stearman knows what's good for him, he'll hype that round table at the conference. People will come for miles with pitchforks and torches over that one.
The latest exhibit, the familiar Kit Kat chocolate-coated wafer, but with the taste of ripe melon and cheese.
Ooh.
Specifically, Hokkaido melon with mascarpone cheese. Or mascarpone? Is that Italian? That's Japanese?
That's Al Capone's brother, mascarpone.
Hmm. As Japanese foodies know, Kit Kats in Japan come in at least 15 coatings, according to a 2013 review by Kotaku.com. Did I pronounce that right? Kotaku?
I've never been there.
Kotaku, thank you.
Totaku.
Including...
Go ahead, sorry.
Including edamame soybean, purple sweet potato, hot Japanese chili, matcha green tea, wasabi, and red bean sandwich.
Red bean sandwich.
That's according to the London Daily Mirror and Kotaku.com.
You know, I'm hungry for a red bean sandwich.
Red bean sandwich.
Sounds good.
Yeah. Go into your nearest 7-Eleven and ask for a red bean sandwich Kit Kat.
I wonder if they'd make a Vegemite Kit Kat.
Excuse me, I'm eager for a hot Japanese chili Kit Kat.
Oh my goodness.
You know, one time I was...
Do you have the new Kit Kat?
This is going out on the radio and all people hearing is beep, 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 beep. Somebody's hitting the button in the station. Beep, 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 beep.
Redacted.
Redacted.
Get out your paper and tape.
You know, 25 years ago, when I was in my early 20s, I worked at a retail place, and this Japanese guy came up to me, and he said, excuse me, do you have any frozen tubes? And I said, and I said, what? And he said, excuse me, do you have any frozen tubes? And I found another guy walking around, and I said, hey, can you help this guy? And he took him around for about 10 minutes, and finally he came back, and he goes, do you know what he wanted? And I said, no, I have no idea. And he said, fluorescent light tubes. But he was saying, do you have any frozen tube?
The Daily Pakistan newspaper, covering the anti-terrorism court in Karachi in April, reported this. This is pretty busy.
Yeah.
This goes with the grenade story we did before.
Yeah.
Reported that a judge in courtroom 3 asked a constable, now like that was relevant to the story.
Not courtroom 2. Get it right.
Courtroom 3, in case you were wondering.
Yeah.
Asked a constable if he knew how the grenade entered into evidence worked. Rather than assume that an explanation was requested, the constable pulled the pin to demonstrate.
Oh,
and the
God.
Resulting explosion injured the constable, a court clerk, and another police officer. The constable is said to be facing severe discipline as soon as he recovers.
Yeah.
That's from Daily Pakistan.
You know, that constable's name was Curly Den Dumbutt.
Pimpin' for Paradise 785.
Yeah. Excuse me, do you know how that grenade works? Let me show you.
Well, as a matter of fact, I do.
Yeah. You know, they say that shortly after that incident, the court quickly adjourned.
They had two other courtrooms until other incidents that will go unspoken.
Well, gentlemen, Gabe Reed, Chad Miles, thank you so much for joining me once again. And up next, we talk to Jeffrey D. Johnson about his new book, The Absurdity of Unbelief, in a moment.
How much of a geek are you? No, seriously, do you think you're a Star Wars expert? Well, take the hardest Star Wars quiz in the world and find out. Go to zippycheese.com and see how well you know the Star Wars movies. There's a quiz for the original trilogy, or, if you dare, take the quiz for the prequel trilogy. What's the name of the creature in the trash compactor in Episode 4? What was the name of the curator of the Jedi Archives in Episode 2? Go to zippycheese.com, take the quiz, and share with your friends. There's also a Marvel comic book quiz. Do you know obscure Marvel comic book characters? We'll find out today. That's zippycheese.com.
Because all non-Christian worldviews are indefensible, it is not sufficient for skeptics to attack Christianity without also defending the foundation for their own unbelief. Everyone has a worldview, even atheists and skeptics. But only the Christian worldview is not self-contradictory. The Absurdity of Unbelief, the new book by Jeffrey D. Johnson, demonstrates why every possible reason for unbelief is irrational and ultimately meaningless by exposing the various self-refuting systems of thought in which these objections are rooted. Again, the book is The Absurdity of Unbelief. And I have to tell you, in an hour-long show, the interview will probably go for less than that, but in an hour-long show, we can't get to everything in this book. That's why you really need to pick up a copy. I've seen the book, I've gone through it, and there is a lot of great information in this book. So again, the book is The Absurdity of Unbelief by Jeffrey D. Johnson. Jeffrey D. Johnson, welcome to the Bruce Collins Show.
Hey, thanks, Bruce. It's really great to be on. I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, it's great to have you on. Now, before we talk about your book, tell us about yourself.
Well, I've been a pastor for the last 15 years. I'm pastoring a Reformed Baptist church in the central Arkansas area, Conway, Arkansas, and been pastoring that church going on 16 years. So it's been a great blessing, and I've been pastoring it just the last couple years. I've gone full-time in the ministry, so it's been really great.
Again, the book this week that we're going to be talking about, which I highly recommend, is The Absurdity of Unbelief by Jeffrey D. Johnson. But before we talk about that book, Jeffrey, can you touch on some of the other books you have written?
I've written a couple books. Kind of the ones that have been more popular is a book on the local church, the importance of the local church. It's called The Church, Why Bother? And I look at the nature of the church, the purpose of the church, and why it's vital for Christians to be members of a local body of believers. And I've written a couple books on covenant theology, one called The Kingdom of God, which looks at the various nature of the Old and New Covenant and how they interact and relate to one another. I've written a book called The Fatal Flaw, which it's examining the infant baptism position. I've written a book on textual criticism. This book that we're currently talking about, The Absurdity of Unbelief.
Now, this book, The Absurdity of Unbelief, again by Jeffrey D. Johnson. So what led you to write this book?
Well, I was actually listening to a debate by Greg Bonson and Gordon Stein. I've listened to it two or three times, and the third time I was going over it, even though I think Greg Bonson won the debate, the presuppositionalist Christian apologist, Greg Bonson, I believe he won the debate, but when I got through, I just thought to myself, of course, a debate's going to be very fluid. Mm-hmm. But I thought, man, if he would have presented the argument, and structured the argument a little differently, not the content was awesome, but kind of the flow of the argument. And I remember going home and after listening to that debate and just writing out an outline, how would I construct the presuppositional argument for the Christian faith? And I wrote an outline, and before you know it, I was writing a book and really didn't intend to do so. But after a couple of years, the book was complete. Hmm.
There's a lot of great information in this book, The Absurdity of Unbelief. Now, one thing that when you talk about faith, a lot of people think, well, faith is just believing in something and there's not a lot of facts surrounding it. And there's a misconception that faith is devoid of reason. So what is faith?
Well, faith is, in the essence of faith, it is trusting God. And there is some sense in which faith looks to that which is invisible, mm-hmm. something that's not seen or something that, let's say, our empirical senses or the scientific method cannot necessarily in and of itself come to the conclusion that there is a God through our senses or through the scientific method. However, saying that, faith is not outside of logic, or it's not illogical, nor is it opposed to the scientific method, nor is it opposed to sense experience. And I think that's kind of where a lot of people have a misconception about faith, even among Christians. A lot of Christians and unbelievers look at faith as some type of middle ground between knowledge and I guess some form of unprovable hopeful knowledge,
yeah.
Or maybe some kind of in between certainty and doubt. Faith kind of, it's not necessarily completely doubt, but it's not complete certainty. So we have to take that leap of faith. We have to just close our mind off to reason and to logic and to science and just go ahead and just trust something that we're not certain. That is what faith is not. Faith is not necessarily based on logic, but it's not illogical. And it's not based upon science, but it's not opposed to science.
And God is not wanting us to be blind to knowledge. He said test everything. The Bible says test everything, so there is that. So how are beliefs shaped?
Well, our beliefs, everybody's beliefs are shaped by many things. Sometimes we don't even realize what's shaping our faith. But one of the things that shapes all of our beliefs is our self-interest. You know, we're not neutral as we would think that we would be. Like, I just want to know the truth. It doesn't matter what the truth is. We slant the truth always typically into our favor. That's why, you know, anything that's opposed to us, we have a hard time believing, or we'll be more resistant to believing. And things that are beneficial to us, it's easier to believe. And that's why people have denial. I've seen that firsthand when I went to a funeral of my friend, and his mother threw herself on the casket of this young boy, and she started shaking the casket saying, "Wake up, Tony, wake up, Tony, wake up, Tony." And, you know, the evidence was right there in front of her that Tony was dead, but it just wasn't welcoming truth. It wasn't good news. It wasn't something that is easy to accept. And therefore, you deny it or you suppress it. And so a lot of times we suppress truth because it's not favorable or it's not good for us. And I think that's a hard thing to swallow. If there is a God and we're sinners, it's easier to say, I'd rather there not be a God, because if there is a God, I'm accountable. Mm-hmm. If there is a God, I'm in trouble. So one of the way people try to suppress that knowledge is to do away with the knowledge of God. And so basically what I try to show in the book, that our self-interest influences us in what we believe more than we think it does. And of course, other things that shape our beliefs are our worldview and our presuppositions. These things ultimately determine what we believe. Because there's no, Bruce, there's no truth that's unconnected to other truth. So what we believe about this truth will shape or influence how we believe and how we accept other truths. So since all truth is interconnected, and all truth together kind of accumulates to form our worldview, no matter what that worldview is, becomes a prism or a guide in which we interpret the things that we believe and the things that we don't believe.
Mm-hmm. Now, I have to ask, by any chance, do you have pet birds?
I sure don't, but I am outside.
Oh, okay. I wondered.
I hope that's not distracting.
No, not at all. In fact, my cats would love it. You know, another thing I've noticed, too, about beliefs is it seems like people as a whole are a lot lazier in developing their beliefs. In other words, beliefs a lot of times are extracted by our television sets or the newspaper we read.
Most definitely, we're shaped by all kinds of influences, and sometimes it can be the smallest thing, but if we hold it firm, that thing will eventually shape other things. And before we know it, it's either we're going to hold an inconsistent system, which many people do. In fact, most people, their worldview is very flawed or inconsistent, and they're not aware of their own flaws. They don't see their inconsistency, but or otherwise, you know. Otherwise, if something comes into our belief system and it's in opposition or contradiction to what we already believe, we're going to have to reject that or reject what we already think we know. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of times people are not really truly filtering knowledge and what they believe and don't believe based upon a solid foundation of truth.
Yeah. Now, in your book, The Absurdity of Unbelief, again by Jeffrey D. Johnson, you write that cohesiveness is important in testing your beliefs. Can you explain this?
Yeah, I mean, everybody has a worldview, and a worldview consists of all your presuppositions, or it's the network of presuppositions. And your presuppositions, by the way, are things you take for granted. And your presuppositions are the basic foundational beliefs that you have. And these presuppositions, we could spend a whole interview on this, but the whole presuppositions are things that we believe that science cannot prove. And we all have them. Even scientists have presuppositions. All scientists, for instance, have some presuppositions about ethics. And they have to take their ethical views into the scientific laboratories. So if a scientist is not honest, which is part of ethics, how would you trust his findings? He pre-assumes that you have to be honest to be a good scientist. But ethics, honesty, is not something science can prove. Well, logic is another one of those presuppositions. Science cannot prove the laws of logic, but if you don't use the laws of logic, you can't do any scientific testing. So your scientist and every other person has presuppositions that cannot be proven by sense experience or by science. But it's these presuppositions that they use to, if you would, to judge all other beliefs. Now, when your worldview becomes flawed, it becomes inconsistent. And if it's inconsistent, it means there's something in your presuppositions at the presuppositional level, or there's something in your worldview that is in error. And so if your worldview cannot stand under its own weight, then you have to step back and say, now, there's something wrong with my belief system. And ultimately, there's something wrong at the presuppositional, at the foundational level of my beliefs. And that's what my book is seeking to do, is say, hey, we all have presuppositions, every one of us. Let's find out what they are. And then let's see, can we build a cohesive worldview on those presuppositions, where the whole systems of beliefs, since they're all interconnected, all of our beliefs are connected with one another. Let's see if we can construct a worldview that doesn't self-destruct under its own weight.
Mm-hmm. That is the voice of Jeffrey D. Johnson. He's the author of the new book, The Absurdity of Unbelief. And you can find this book at many places, but especially Amazon.com is a really easy place to go tonight to get this book, The Absurdity of Unbelief. Now, Jeffrey, in one section of your book, you discuss in detail the irrationality of many non-biblical beliefs. One of them is evolution. Can you dissect the concept of evolution in terms of its irrationality?
Yeah, well, what the book does, it goes through all the major worldviews and then it deconstructs them. It shows how they're inconsistent with themselves. Well, evolution as a scientific, naturalistic worldview, it's based upon naturalism, which is a belief that there is no such thing as God, or at least God can't be brought into the equation. So every answer has to be answered by something that can be tested by your senses, or by your, by, you know, your taste, touch, you know, smell, and so forth. And so, however, the laws of science are based upon the laws of logic. If you remove the laws of logic, and especially mathematics, if you remove mathematics away from the laws of nature and the laws of science, then the scientific laws, every one of them, the law of gravity principally, all your laws of nature would self-erupt without the use of logic and without the use particularly of mathematics. And now mathematics in itself cannot be proven by the scientific method. So naturalism says, hey, we have to be able to put it into the laboratory to make sure it's legitimate. But it can't even do that at the presuppositional level. It cannot even do that with the laws of science. So it self-destructs. And, of course, in the book, I don't just explain that, but I go and explain how evolution in itself is contrary to the law of biogenesis, the laws of the reproductive principles, contrary to the irreducible complex principle, and it doesn't give account for consciousness, and it's not supported by the fossil records. I try to show how evolution is not supported even by the science. And then I seek to put in many, many quotes by different atheists and different naturalistic scientists, where at their weak moments they make concessions. Yes, we're basing our belief on evolution on a philosophy or a worldview based on naturalism, which naturalism in and of itself we cannot prove by the laws of science.
Yeah. It takes a lot of faith to believe in evolution. I mean, it's pretty unbelievable. Now, you know, something that's very alarming today is there are a lot of older Christian denominations that seem to be bringing about a desire to meld themselves with other religions. And it harkens to almost the end times, prophetical timeline. So let's talk about Islam. How is Islam irrational?
Well, Islam, like, you know, the Jehovah's Witness and Mormons, like many worldviews and religious beliefs that deny the Trinity, it's irrational because ultimately it cannot explain why there is diversification within the world. The universe has a unity, but also there's diversity. And Islam can explain unity because God is one, Allah is one. But since there's no three persons in the Godhead of Allah, there's no grounds for there to be diversification. And so I explain that, but at the more basic level, at the more kind of for the everyday evangelist to take on the street, the basic reason Islam is irrational is because it cannot have a holy God, a just God, and also have forgiveness. Allah in the Quran is very arbitrary. He forgives based upon whims and just kind of based upon him just doing so, but there's no grounds, there's no legal grounds for him to forgive. And it would just be just as immoral for Allah to forgive his followers as it would be the judge to forgive the murderer just because he wants to. That would be a crime. You know, the scriptures teach that those who forgive the guilty is an abomination. Those who overlook the crimes of the guilty and forgo punishment is an abomination, because the Bible speaks of a just God, where Allah cannot be just and merciful at the same time. Mm-hmm. And so that's the beauty of Christianity, and that's the basic irrationality of Islam.
Wow, that is a great point. I never had considered that. That is an excellent point. The book is The Absurdity of Unbelief by Jeffrey D. Johnson. Of course, you can go on Amazon.com tonight and order a copy. And we're also going to, at the end, we're going to talk about where you can go online to find out more information about this book. Now, Jeffrey, you have a section of your book called The Grounds for Belief, and you touched on the grounds for belief for Islam. But we obviously don't have time, as I said at the beginning of this interview, we don't have time to go over all of the points in the book, and they are substantial. So that's a good reason for people to pick up a copy of the book. But you write about reason and scientific evidence supporting Christianity. Can you go over that?
Yeah, we talked about what faith is, and faith does believe in things that are invisible. However, faith is not opposed to reason. In fact, in this book, I show that Christianity is the only rational worldview. It's the only consistent, logical worldview, and all other worldviews are irrational. They're logically inconsistent. They self-destruct under their own weight, and that is the beauty of Christianity. So The thrust of this book shows how Christianity is able to construct this beautiful system with all of its parts flowing from the presuppositions and producing this collective, consistent, cohesive system of thought. And of course, I break down and deconstruct all other systems, showing how they're fatally flawed. So it's reasonable, but it's also supported by the evidence. The human DNA, for instance, has enough information. In fact, some say it's 3.5 billion letters which is enough information to fill 12 sets of 32 volumes of Encyclopedia Britannica volumes. And that is a lot of information.
Yeah.
In fact, that's almost unfathomable. And Bill Gates says this about DNA. He says DNA is like a computer program, but far, far more advanced than any software ever created. Now, none of us would look at a computer program like Windows 10 or whatever program it is and say, that just happened. When we see that information and that data, we see all these letters and figures that formulate this recognizable knowledge. We safely can conclude that there has to be an intelligent mind behind such information. In fact, it would be more absurd to think that such information that's recorded in the human DNA just evolved or just happened by coincidence than to believe that there is an intelligent mind. In fact, Stephen Meyer says an intelligent mind is not only a explanation, it's the only scientific explanation. So that's, again, faith does believe in God, and God in itself cannot be seen by the scientific method or proven by the scientific method. However, all of science only makes sense if there's a God who created an orderly universe with the laws of nature and the laws of logic.
It's interesting because over the years, archaeologists have found things that at one time they thought, well, we can't find any evidence of this historical site that's talked about in the Bible, and then they would find it. And over the years, a lot of archaeological evidence has been found proving situations and people and sites that were written about in the Bible. So the historical accuracy of the Bible is pretty compelling, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, it wasn't long ago that people saying the Hittites, which the Bible speaks about, that was a myth. They were just a mythical people. And of course, it wasn't long ago that they discovered and unearthed records about the Hittites there in Turkey. And the same thing with the Assyrian king Sargon, who's mentioned in Isaiah 20, verse 1. Many of, you know, your historians and archaeologists would say, no, there's no such thing. There's no such person as the king of Sargon until, of course, they found in a palace wall, his name is inscribed in the palace wall there in Iraq. So, you know, a lot of people have questioned many of the historical facts or historical records of the Old Testament and even the New Testament. But all these people who have questioned, eventually, these things have been unearthed. In fact, there's no denying that Jesus Christ is a real person.
Yeah.
Who lived. In fact, the evidence of his resurrection is astounding. So it's pretty, the evidence of Christianity, the historical evidence, and the archaeological evidence is truly overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Again, the book is The Absurdity of Unbelief by Jeffrey D. Johnson. Now, Jeffrey, we have a large Christian audience that listens to the show, but we also have, we're on a secular radio station. So we have people from all different backgrounds and all different worldviews listening to this program. So regarding your book, The Absurdity of Unbelief, if you could leave our listener with one big thought about this book, what would it be?
Yeah, I'd go back to what I've been alluding to in the thrust of the book, is that everybody has a worldview. It's good for us to kind of uncover what that worldview is, even if we're not familiar or sure what our worldview is. What are the basic presuppositions? What are the things I believe at the heart of all my beliefs? What's the foundation of all my beliefs? And for Christianity, we have a sure foundation, and our foundation is the Word of God. And it happens to be that the Word of God does produce a system or a worldview that can be logically consistent. And then when we look at every other worldview, if it be other religious worldviews, which I talk about in the book, from Islam to pantheism to many of the Eastern religions, or if it be naturalism or atheism, and all these worldviews, when you go to connect their beliefs and show how their beliefs are interconnected, that there's these major inconsistencies, these major contradictions. And it's not just minor contradictions, but they're contradictions at the basic level. And so we all may be wrong on who won the 1976 World Series, but if I'm wrong about that fact, it doesn't destroy my worldview. But if I'm wrong about the question of God or the question of ethics or the question of how I know what I know, if I'm wrong on that level, then I have to question everything I believe. And so Christianity produces a system of thought that gives us the confidence to have a worldview that not only we can believe in, but we can actually live our lives. And I would say in conclusion, all other worldviews break down when you go to live it. You know, relativism sounds great in the classroom, but no one lives by it. Postmodernism sounds great in the classroom, but no one balances their checkbook based upon the principles of postmodernism, because it breaks down when you go to apply it. Christianity does not break down when you live it out. Mm-hmm. Now, Christians can be hypocritical and live inconsistent to their worldview, but when they do, there's some consequences to being inconsistent or hypocritical. Atheists and naturalists and all other worldview opponents, they have to purposely live inconsistent, and they purposely have to be hypocritical to their worldview to make sure they live in a way that's not have damaging consequences to their lives.
You just brought up something that I have to ask. Do you know who won the 1976 World Series?
Yeah, the Mets.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm from Northern California, so I know that the 1972 to 1974 was won by the Oakland A's.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 76 is the year I was born, so I had to look that up. That was the year I was born, so I happen to know that one.
Now, before you go, where can people find out more information about you and your book, The Absurdity of Unbelief?
Okay, there's a website for the book. It's called theabsurdityofunbelief.com. You can check out that website, and it gives you information about the book. Or you could go directly to amazon.com, and I do have an author's page connected to The Absurdity of Unbelief. There's an author page. You can learn about me. You can follow me on Twitter if you like, or check me out on Facebook. But if anybody out there has questions, I do try to interact with anybody that emails me or sends me a message, either through Twitter or Facebook. I'll be glad to interact as much as I can.
Great. And again, I highly recommend this book. It's an outstanding book, and it'll equip any believer, and it will help unbelievers, I believe, in their pursuit of the truth. The book is The Absurdity of Unbelief by Jeffrey D. Johnson. Jeffrey, this has been great, and hope we can have you back again sometime.
I loved it, Bruce. Thanks for having me on. It really is truly an honor to be on your show.
Thank you once again for joining us here on The Bruce Collins Show, where we broadcast every Thursday night at 10 p.m. right here at WWPR 1490 a.m. Remember, God loves you. We do too. Don't give up.